We are meeting this beautiful Sunday in an attempt to come together and consider ideas as ancient as the night of time. We do this as an independent study, but collectively, mind reaching mind helps us to assimilate these ideas. There is work to be done that is so incredibly enormous and absorbing that what you'll hear from the platform is simply the ideas of the United Lodge of Theosophists, of Theosophy, rather than any side issues. Everyone is welcome to give opinions and present ideas, and they'll be discussed. The unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever found, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. The teachings come from the original writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge in the last 25 years of the 1800s, carried forward for our use. We're not an organization, there are no officers, there's no bylaws, there are no dues. We are independently sustained completely by contributions from those who feel moved to offer time, service, or money as is possible for them. And you can see the person at the book table if you are interested in that. And we are told on the back of the schedule is the declaration. It's a wonderful short little document to read when you have time. But we are told that the true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all, because anyone in the service of their brother or sister, we call a Theosophist. So this lodge meets twice weekly at the current time. Sunday mornings, as today, doors open at 10:30. The meeting runs from 11 till noon. Wednesday evenings, doors open at 5:30, and the reference library is open from 5:30 to 7:30, where you can investigate all kinds of topics. And you'll find students everywhere. None of us is teachers or professors or anything. We're all students of this philosophy. And then at 7:45 p.m. on Wednesdays, we have a study class, which runs till 9 p.m. And currently, we're using the notes on the Bhagavad Gita, as well as the Gita itself, for reference. Very interesting subjects. And the book table in the center of the building has straight-line theosophical writings and teachings at the cost of printing and publishing. We are a nonprofit, so if you'd like to take these ideas home with you, that's where you can find someone to help you with that. So this morning, we were trying to get an idea of what the overall topic is, the self. And from when we're small, we ask, who am I? And the identification in that question is what leads us from direction to direction all throughout our lives. So who am I, visible and invisible, is what we are taking up this morning. Who is the true man, the real man? Is he the same as the visible man? Is there something within that is beyond, above, and fuels that? So we have, did everybody get the paper for today, for July 14th? Okay, great. We have three pages stapled. And process is going to be, we're going to take three readings, but like last week, we're going to do a reading, have discussion on it, second reading, discussion, and go forward, because the ideas are collated out. Some of the readings go right along with the text, and some have other pieces brought in, so don't be disturbed if you can't follow along with the reading. But they're short, so listen carefully. The first reading.
From the very day when the first mystic found the means of communication between the world and the worlds of the invisible host, between the sphere of matter and that of pure spirit. He concluded that to abandon this mysterious science to the profanation of the rabble was to lose it. An abuse of it might lead mankind to speedy destruction. The first self-made adept initiated but a select few and kept silence with the multitudes. He recognized this God and felt the great being within himself.
He recognized this God and felt the great being within himself. One of the first phrases that caught our eye is that between the sphere of matter and that of pure spirit. What does that mean? Any ideas? The sphere of matter and that of pure spirit. Are they one? Are they separated? Are they connected? Yes.
Well, if by matter we're talking about the gross physical plane, mm-hmm. and that of pure spirit, it would seem that there's some kind of gradations. You know, nature doesn't just jump from one to the other.
That's a very good way to put it. There's gradations, there's levels of development from matter to spirit. And they are not different in essence, rather in expression or presentation. So this subject proposes that we can know both. We are very, very familiar with the plane of matter. We look at one another and we see different color eyes and different color hair and what we do for a job, etc., etc., and we recognize that very, very well. What we haven't learned to recognize or have to some degree is the plane of spirit. And then it says, this mysterious science was only given to a few because an abuse of it might lead to man's destruction. Where do we see that idea repeated in religions? Anything come to mind? We were thinking in the Christian faith, Jesus had the crowd that he spoke to, and then he had the 12 disciples, the elect few, who were devoted, disciple, one who will sacrifice, one who will cleanse the spirit and wish to be in service of that one and their teachings. And it's interesting that all of those adepts and reformers and holy ones always said, follow me, not follow my teachings. But why would it be destruction if the mass were to get these very mysterious or occult teachings? Any ideas? Yes?
It just seems, you know, the idea of if knowledge is power, that, well, the more power one has, the more he has the opportunity to be of service to others. Or, depending on his character and his moral position, he might use that power to be of greater service to himself.
Character, morality, ethics, definitely. Was your hand up? No? Okay. Yes, it is power. Knowledge is power. That we can all agree upon. The more we know, the greater the breadth of what we can achieve in whatever field that is. When we were learning addition, we could never imagine that physics existed. But if we held through the levels of learning, eventually we got to algebra or whatever level it was. Thinking about the great mystery schools, we remember hearing the Pythagorean school. There was a 7-year period where there was great learning of math and music and sciences before you would even be considered for the mystery school. So all of that comes along the way. Yes, in the back?
Well, when we consider that for many, many years, two pieces of flint were struck together to get a spark for fire. And someone discovered the chemical necessary to make combustible flour. It wasn't dynamite. It was from the house.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how many lost their lives not knowing how to.
Yes, exactly. That knowledge given to a few who were experts. We could think in an army they have different positions. You will be in charge of the tanks, you will be in charge of the soldiers, you will at that time be in charge of the gunpowder and making sure the rifles are loaded, etc. And if that mixture wasn't right, there was destruction. Well, those fiery ideas that describe and try to help us see and understand spirit are the same way. They're a power so terrific that at the point we are in our learning and evolution, we can only grasp some of it. And a little knowledge, what's the saying? Knowledge is power and absolute knowledge is something. I can't remember.
Power corrupts.
Thank you. Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's the dark side of it, shall we say. Knowledge is power, and we have the choice how to use that power. Yes?
That's so pretty cool. It's not only the power and how to use it properly so that you don't have accidents, but there is a question of ethics. What are you going to use that power for? Are you using it for the good of mankind or for your selfish purposes, destroying others or whatever? And if you haven't developed that ethics, that discrimination, these powers can be very dangerous.
And we think discrimination is one of the hardest things to get a handle on. We come upon a situation and our intuition tells us this is something we are meant to act within. It's brought to us, so it's something we recognize. If we go this way, there'll be a certain outcome. If we go this way, another, choosing the right way without doing harm is something that takes a lot of practice and studying the results and discrimination being cultivated through that. And we hope that we don't do harm along the way. So, yes?
There is the nice story of the Sorcerer's Apprentice. Anybody who's seen Fantasia will know what that's about.
Mm-hmm.
The apprentice had some knowledge and he got all this stuff going and then he didn't know how to stop it.
Exactly. The Sorcerer's Apprentice, that's exactly right. And notice the last line of that, the first self-made adept initiated but a select few and kept silence with the multitudes. Self-made being the first phrase. It is an independent, individual, self-made effort that each one of us takes on through evolution of lifetimes. And then kept silence with the multitudes. Again, there's that separation of this is sacred knowledge, and unless I am called upon it and I recognize that the teacher is calling upon me, I should be silent, which in itself is a difficult thing to do because you want to share that knowledge when you get to that point. Yes.
Well, throughout HBTV's teachings, she always talks about personal responsibility, issues related to self-induced efforts, and self-induced means and self-devised methods. Now, this says the first self-made adept, okay, initiated a select few. So then does that mean that they didn't really have to do the work?
I'm sorry, that they didn't really
have to do the work. What is this about he
sure.
initiated a select few? Well, adept is self-evolved. What is this bit about an adept can initiate someone into adeptship?
It's a difficult phrase. What we know from the philosophy is that there is a group of self-made masters, holy ones, elevated thinkers, those who have complete control over all the faculties of their nature and the world at large, and that they came together and not only tested things out for themselves, but then tested one against another. So we think maybe that initiation is that process, making sure the truth that the one has found is the truth and not partial truth. Okay, go ahead.
So perhaps an analogy for that would be, in Western medicine, we're to a level and we have experienced it for 100 years, and much of it has been trial and error, but we've gotten somewhere with it. Well, students shouldn't be expected to for trial and error for hundreds of years, and so maybe the initiation for a student into medical school is first they get their four-year undergrad, and they take particular courses, and they get really high grades. It demonstrates their competency in their education. And once that's proven, then the initiation is the acceptance into med school.
Into that school, exactly. And we know the phrase, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Yes.
Yeah, but isn't the truth that we are all self-made? In every aspect of our life, we're self-made. And what we are living now, it's from the past. Things that we have set up, and we are constantly creating our future by acting in the present, and we make the decisions which colors our future.
Absolutely, Theosophy would agree with you 100%. So in that sense, there is nothing other than being self-made. It is, however, up to us how we use those powers that we all have. We all have the powers of the senses, the power to think, the power to imagine, the power to will. But how do we use it? I need to get this done today, but I think I'll go watch that movie I really wanted to see. The desire took over the impulse to go and perform a duty, and the self, and we'll stay with that for now, went with it. So what happens? That duty is still waiting. We all know this, and we can either take care of it now or it will come back to us. And that is the karma, the lessons that we're creating now that we're not finishing, that will be waiting for us in future lives.
Yes. And let's not forget that it's the ethics and the morals.
Yes.
That best
should guide
human beings. And the rule, don't do to another that which you would not have done to yourself.
Yes.
And the universal law of karma.
Yes. For ethics, we need look at nothing other than that. Do not do to another what you would not have done to yourself. All right, let's take up the second reading, please.
In the hymns of the Veda, we see man left to himself to solve the riddle of this world. There, too, in his own breast, he has discovered a power that is never mute when he prays, never absent when he fears and trembles. It seems to live in him and yet to support him and all around him. From the days of the primitive man down to our modern age, there has not been a philosopher worthy of that name who did not carry in the silent sanctuary of his heart the grand and mysterious truth. If initiated, he learnt it as a sacred science. If otherwise, then, like Socrates, repeating to himself as well as to his fellow man the noble injunction, "O man, know thyself," he succeeded in recognizing his God within himself.
Thank you. As the oracle in Delphi, man, know thyself. It's repeated throughout history. We say, who am I? What am I? What's my purpose? Man, know thyself. That's the whole underlying recognition that makes our lives fruitful and helpful and eventually selfless in the service of others, or selfish and personal and for our own gain only. And there we see a duality. We're starting to see that there is the lower tendencies, desires, thoughts, or the higher. So there is the man of matter and the man of spirit. He meets in this form that we all see. What is that grand and mysterious truth that must be in the sanctuary of the heart? Any ideas?
We're trying to find...
We had said earlier, we apologize, there, it's collated from different pieces.
Okay. Different tenses throughout.
Yeah. In his own breast, he discovered a power that is never mute when he prays, never absent when he fears and trembles. And there was not a poet that did not, philosopher rather, that did not carry in the silent sanctuary of his heart the grand and mysterious truth. What is the grand and mysterious truth?
Well, for his would be that famous phrase, I think, therefore I am.
Descartes.
And it's an invitation to look within, the contemplation.
Yes.
However, if we will read the printed page, and then when we get to the end of the paragraph, it says, well, I read that, what was it all about? Without independently going over and over again, think about it. And this is that depth mentioned in these words, man, know thyself.
Yes. We are called thinkers in theosophy. That is truly what we are. We are thinkers. At all times, we are mind beings. So the phrase, I think, therefore I am, is the closest clue we'll get. Let's try to... Go ahead, I'm sorry, your hand was up.
I think there's more to it than just that. Listen to what's being said between what's being said here. It's this still small voice. It's this silence. If you're always thinking, you never have an experience with that. You're never going to actually. I mean, yes, I think therefore I am. The fact that you are thinking suggests yes. I need to go in and see what this thing is, which is thinking, but then also what is witnessing this thinking. And maybe those two things aren't necessarily the same thing.
Okay. We can come back to that. We got some hands on that, yes.
And some of the questions you're asking, I'm suspecting there might be as many answers as there are individuals. And several of them, I couldn't answer them at all at this point. But purpose was mentioned today, and I've never established one in my life. The purpose I use is borrowed out of literature, where it says you have one purpose, to heal and to further that into the world.
Wonderful. It's a compassionate, loving, ethical thought to heal and to help the world. It's a wonderful way to live your life. Way in the back?
In the Bible, there's a verse that says, be still and know that I am God.
I am God.
And I believe it's in Romans, but theosophically, that would be the grand and mysterious truth.
Exactly.
And we are all individually God.
Yes. If we take away, thinking of that duality, if we take away that which is temporary and changeable, we know these forms have changed greatly since we were kids, and we've grown 3 inches, and we celebrate that, and then our hair color changes as we get older, and everything that is changeable is temporary. the soldiers coming back from the wars of today have lost limbs, have lost body parts. They are changeable. They are starting new lives with a different array of the physical. But that which is still and silent and changeless is that I am I. No separate, no different from I am God, in the sense that God means a universal oneness, a unity, a spirit, a spiritual soul. We are all that. The amnesiac can still say, I don't know my name. I don't know where I came from. I am. But I don't remember any of the temporary trappings. They may come back a little bit at a time, but the I am is still and silent. We find it in the silence, as was said. We suspend the thinking on this plane and look within. But that is the grand and mysterious truth. And if I am one with the all, how could I ever be less than that, my potential? Yes?
You mentioned specifically the heart. I guess I just wanted to share something that I experienced when I took refuge in Buddhism in Dharamsala, where the Tibetan monks teach to Westerners. And I think anyone who has gone to a Tibetan temple has seen that they do these prostrations when they go into the temple.
Yes.
So they salute to the head, to the mouth, and then to the heart, and then they bow down on the floor.
Yes.
And I had to ask, what is this? Can you explain this to me? How do I do it properly? Because you can ape people and get it out of sequence. And the Lama explained to me in detail that you're actually saluting body, speech, mind, and asking for purification as you do that. And I'm like, but anatomically, why is the mind here? This is the heart. I mean, this is the brain. What's going on?
Right.
Does that make any sense? Is there a parable or an esoteric truth in this gesture that's been going on for thousands of years?
Yeah.
And, I mean, he didn't fully explain, but it seems that what the Tibetans believe is that the Buddha nature, the real mind, is in the heart.
The real mind is in the heart.
Mm.
That which we set out to do is colored by our motive lies within and is saturated with what's truly in our heart, whether we call it motive or ethics or anything else. The supreme law of laws is compassion. So that must well up in the heart. If we've ever seen tragedy, We've all seen tragedy in our lifetimes, whether it was on TV, in newspaper, or live. There's something that wells up within us. That is the compassion that another soul is suffering. And that is what the Buddha, the Jesus, Krishna, are able to call upon at any moment. They live in that. So Theosophy might also interpret those motions as the thinking, how we think, the ideas we hold. Speech being so important because we're impressing the whole world around us with how we express what we're thinking, and the heart being the seat of that. Thank you. Yes.
That last contribution was really interesting. It reminds us that in Theosophy we're told about, you know, there is head learning and there is heart learning. There are, you know, articles that really apply more to the heart and really, rather than mechanically or, you know, methodologically or logically applying Theosophy, to use your compassion with it. And one, if you've read about this or not, you know, there's something called heart math, which is kind of a new approach to it, and it's pretty interesting. It's pretty awesome. And it even demonstrated that there's 30 or 40,000 neurons in our heart, and our heart and brain communicate with each other through the vagus, through the vagus nerve, and it's those who, you know, master the eye doctrine are operating from there, rather the heart doctrine are not operating from their head, but really are operating from there.
Right. And that, you know, throughout the day, we're operating from the eye doctrine or the heart doctrine, from the knowledge base of this outside world or the emotional recognition, the full recognition of the spirit within. We haven't mastered it yet. That's why they're called masters. But that is our trek. That is the mysterious truth we seek to fully understand and fully recognize in every moment. That's what all these reincarnation lives are for. Yes.
We would imagine then that Buddha was the great compassionate being. So the idea of compassion and saying that we all have that Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that heart quality tempered by mind.
Yes. Do we all know the story of Gautama the Buddha? Very quickly.
Somewhat.
He was born into royalty in living in a palatial estate where the walls were high enough that he couldn't see the poverty of the city around him, of the village around him. But something as he grew in age, something within him stirred. And he said to his father was the king, I must see what's out there. So it was a planned visit. And all the beggars and all the people who were not well were taken off the streets. So he took a ride through the town and it looked perfectly normal. Some years past that, he snuck out of the palace and found the ill, the beggars, those who were in desperate, desperate need. And his heart, his compassion swelled to such a degree that he could never go back to being separate from. He recognized that unity or have so much while so many suffered. So he's called the Buddha of compassion because that welled up in such a degree in his heart that it changed the entire course of his life. And then eventually it is said he sat under the Bodhi tree and reached enlightenment where he was able to blend it all. Now that is a soul we imagine who worked lifetimes upon lifetimes of understanding these principles. And that lifetime in which that happened would be the bloom or the essence of the very highest expression of that. So we're all working along the same path. Sometimes we're working harder than others, and we just try to redirect ourselves when we get off that path. There was a hand in the back.
When we look back, we've been studying these writings here, and we compare our ability that of our ancestors. They seem to have had an insightfulness that we don't. Now, we have college degrees, brilliant in certain areas, but there is something missing which they had, and many of ours could neither hardly write or hardly read. But when we look at read these articles and we remember some of the songs they sang, some of the things they said, we find that it is closely in resemblance to these current pages we have here, which we begin to interpret. And we're talking about no specific race, because we know that many of our ancestors came here to America.
From other places.
From some kind of ship, one way or the other.
Okay. Right.
And that might be an important thing to consider.
So
how brilliant we are, how intelligent some of those ancestors are.
There's some very important points in what was said that we'd like to break it apart a little bit. That which we call common sense is what we have all agreed upon, basically, whether it was active or not. Those, don't put your finger in the fire, you'll get burnt. Those phrases that we'd go, to our parents or grandparents, but that stayed with us, are the little pearls of wisdom meant for us to understand them when the time was right. And the other point made was that how different the times were. Not so long ago, we were an agrarian society. We followed the cycles, the seasons, the sun, the harvesting, etc. We started the Industrial Revolution and little by little lost touch with nature, unless we made a point to go to it. Not everyone. There are still farmers and those who really appreciate nature. But we, our generation, the last few generations, have come up with many, many, many distractions which take up the time perhaps we might spend reading, learning, discussing these kinds of ideas with one another, to the detriment. You know, we were fortunate enough at our age to have had dinners at the table with the whole family there. And everyone gave input, and everyone got the benefit of that. It may not be possible today due to the kind of society we've created, but we can still attempt to hold those insightful pearls of wisdom in our heart, recognize them as they come up, and share them. We've been speaking, whispering in each other's ears for millennia. This was the first time in history we know of that these ideas were put into print. So we're very, very fortunate. But listen to the whispers of your elders. They have the experience. They have the knowledge that you are trying so hard to attain. And yet we are all one. Yes?
So this grand and mysterious truth, therefore, is the oneness of life.
The oneness.
That we are not separate from it. We are,
yes.
And everything, it's like a ripple effect. We affect everything, and things have an effect on us. So
yes.
The oneness.
Absolutely. The great fallacy is separateness, that we believe what the physical eyes tell us, that we are separate from one another in any way. There's a process, mental process called shaving. If we shave away the temporary, the things that change, the body, the job, the working conditions, that which I identify, I'm an artist, I'm a poet, just continually shave away that which is not permanent. And what you come up with is, I am one with all. And that is expressed in our declaration as universal brotherhood. And we include sisterhood in that. But it's just a simple way to express it. Understanding that if we look deeply into the eyes of another, it's a singular act. We are celebrating the oneness in the other. The separateness that we automatically sometimes think of when we look at another is what is doing us harm, because it's not real. It's not real. The outer trappings are temporary and evanescent, and they go when we die. There's something that continues on. Yes?
Does your most recent words shed some insight on the initial question that you asked regarding the relationship between the sphere of matter and pure spirit?
Yes.
And that process of shaving, as you called it, is an aspect of the, as it's called here, the mysterious science?
Yes, exactly right. And that is that duality that I mentioned. It's where we decide to place our focus. I am sick, I am tired, I need this, I'm thirsty, I want this, I want that, I don't care about this. That is all centered in the desires of the physical man, of the matter, the plane of matter. And when we take the opportunity to sit quietly and turn within, we realize I am all. My brother is myself. That's the essence of do no harm to another as you would not have them harm you. In harming another, you harm yourself. It's the same. And that spirit that resides, Theosophy says we are all a reflection of that unity. So if I'm a reflection of it, I can be in potential as great as it in the sense of recognition of that if I allow myself to be. If I take my mind off the lower desires, the things that satisfy temporarily, again, they're changeable, aren't they? I like this before, now I want that. And we look to the things that are permanent. Friendships, relationships, family, those we haven't met yet who may need our services somehow, those who offer services to us, and perhaps we shun, but that may be their opportunity, their karmic opportunity. So it's a different way of looking at the world. And it is a mystery, but it's where we place our enormous power of mind. How did I will this to happen? How did that happen? How can I imagine a light bulb and then hold one in my hand? How did it get from here to here? Yes?
And in keeping with the real meaning behind this article, an example in the drug field, thousands of years ago, especially in the Far East, opium, cocaine, for medication used by those who knew how to apply it for the benefit. Now, somehow or other, since then, it's got into the head of we children. And we use it. And lo and behold, we have destroyed untold children, adults.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a real expert to try to recover that individual who used a drug harmless if used
properly, ethically.
A perfect example of how they were reluctant to give these ideas to the masses.
Right.
We see every day in the newspaper what happens.
And if that one had the opportunity to consider who and what they really are, they might have been able to save themselves. But Theosophy says any movement toward truth is never lost. Anything that we make in a positive direction, well, everything is kept, but we never lose any of the work that we do. And we have to remember that although it sounds horrible, it makes perfect sense that the Buddha said, life is suffering. And we forget that that's true because we believe in the temporary, in that which does not exist. This plane is not real, it's maya or illusion considered with that which is within. So the suffering has to take place. We need to get to our third reading, please.
We cannot attain the kingdom of heaven unless we unite ourselves indissolubly with the Lord of splendor and light, our immortal God. We must first conquer immortality and take the kingdom of heaven by violence offered to our material selves. From the remotest antiquity, mankind as a whole have always been convinced of the existence of a personal spiritual entity within the personal physical man. This inner entity was more or less divine according to its proximity to the crown, Christos, there is an ever-present instinctive feeling of the proximity of another spiritual and invisible world, which, though it be subjective to the senses of the outward man, is perfectly objective to the inner ego.
Thank you. Again, depending on where we're looking. And that Christos, we're thinking Jesus the Christ. There are two forms of that word. Christos is a reflection of spirit. Christos with an I, or Christ, is the realization that all is one and therefore nothing can be separate from the spirit. So the one who has attained to that understanding would be called the Christ. We are all the Christos. We're working on that understanding.
No, I just wanted to clarify the Jesus Christ is a compound name. His name was Jesus, and Christ was given to him because of the
title.
You're just saying?
Yes, the title. Absolutely. Like Gautama the Buddha.
Yeah.
Yes, it's a title of reference to the work that's been done.
And again, if you don't mind clarifying for me, Christ means what in its Greek, right?
Christos is the realization, the complete realization, that all is one and therefore nothing can be separate from spirit. It's the full, Theosophy says we are sevenfold in nature, that we have four constituents that die and change with each new lifetime, each new embodiment. But the three higher, the spirit, the reflection of spirit, the mind, carry forward, almost like it said, like a chain of pearls on a necklace, the lifetimes. That continues. That is that reflection of spirit. That continues. That is permanent. So once there is a complete recognition that there really truly is no separation, that everything is spirit, then the Christos has the right to be called Christos.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes.
We recall reading an article by Albert Einstein. Everyone knows Einstein's contribution.
One of my favorites.
And he went through several areas involving his discoveries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he said he couldn't go any further, and then he sat down and looked within himself. And in the light of those contemplative moments, he says, to that extent, with all of what he contributed, I am religious. Now, what we have to do is think about that, not just the words, and think about what Einstein contributed.
Absolutely.
To the, and yet he's saying he went so far, only so far, that he had to look within himself and then
And religion, the root of the word religion is religiare, we think it is in Latin, meaning to bind back, to bind together, that which brings us back to the truth. So one of our favorites is imagination is more important than knowledge, one of his quotes, because everything begins in imagination. And then knowledge is formed by that. So anything we can imagine, we can make possible. We all have the same power. Whether it's used for good or for ill, as we were talking about, or our intentions, our motive, our ethics are positive or negative, is completely up to us, but it will have an impression on everything and everyone in the world. So it really makes us stop and think, hopefully stop and think before we speak or act, what that impression will be. And thank those who have helped us along the way, because none of us does this alone. It is a singular journey we must accomplish independently. But we're told, Theosophy says, we're never alone. We're never left without a spiritual helper, an elder brother or sister. Yeah.
In that same sense, we have to reach up to that elder brother, for they, you know, they can't come to us.
Right.
We have to go to them. And that's what's so unusual about the Nihilology of Theosophists, because we have writings that date back to the night of time and that were only given out at the feet of a master. But for the first time, they've been written down.
Yep.
So that the Western mind can grasp the metaphysical ideas that are
yes.
expressed there. But Theosophy, or the ULT, gives an opportunity for everyone
yep.
through their own efforts.
Through
to
their
learn
own
and
efforts.
To study.
Absolutely. And going back to what was said about Einstein, we're told this is a small portion. The part we have of Theosophy to study is a small portion of the whole, because we're not in a state of readiness to receive more than this. So as we prepare ourselves, as we do that work of spirit and recognizing each other as brother and sister, we make ourselves more open and porous to that spirit within, which can only be expressed through us. Yes.
There's this passage I like, but it's awfully hard to apply. It states that when you meet anyone, it's a holy encounter. As you see them, you'll see yourself, and as you treat them, you'll treat yourself, and as you think of them, you'll think of yourself. Never forget this, because in them, you'll find yourself or lose yourself.
Absolutely. And your greatest enemy might be your best teacher. Because if we have an aversion to something, it's stirring something within our very selves. So we have a reflection of that. And this may be an opportunity for us to seek that out within and then someday be able to thank the other for that, even if it was harmful to us at the time, or so we felt. But yes, look into the eyes of another and realize they are us. Mm-hmm. So how do we reach that God within? Yes, I'm sorry, your hand.
Well, it says these ideas of these truths will remain silent. We're talking about Socrates, but all the other, if you gain this knowledge, you have to keep it secret.
Mm-hmm.
Why would that be true?
If we gain this knowledge, this higher knowledge, part of the discipline of learning it is to be able to keep it silent or secret. Why is that, do we think? Yes?
There are medications. If you give one tenth of a grain, you'll heal the worst disease. Change that dosage just a little bit and you will kill a whole
kill the person. Sure. Right. We have no way of knowing where another person is along the path, what will reach their hearts, what will inflame their minds. If we have come to a point where we have learned something so special, and truth never changes, that's another way we know it's truth. It is not appropriate to share that with another, as their entire reason for evolution is to find it on their own. We can give hints, you know, if it's an appropriate time, perhaps we talk to someone about, what are your thoughts on reincarnation? Do you think we come back and stir a conversation rather than I have proved for myself that reincarnation and karma are laws of the universe. And they'd go, really, that's nice. You've missed an opportunity. So the deepest truths remain silent to keep them sacred, first of all, and to allow your brother or sister the opportunity to find them in their own time. Yes.
Yeah, it was said earlier that here at the ULT, you know, everyone's invited to come in and learn what what's going on in Theosophy to find the principles. And what we find interesting is in the teachings of Theosophy in this library right here, really, it's all there. That's what we're told. And two people can come in on the same day with the same level of interest because they've heard this and they've heard that. And one person will open these books and jump into it like a duck into water and get it. And another person with the same level of interest, it can take years of rereading the same books before they really start to get it. Yep. Why is that the difference? And we don't think it has necessarily to do with intellect.
No, we wouldn't say it has to do with intellect. Perhaps the mind is of such a state that it is open to a new idea, or is just maybe considering it and playing with it. You know, a good portion of what we hold as true, each of us, was given to us somewhere along the way. In the beginning, it's in childhood, it might be a religious belief. As we get older, some other things. But we're given these and that sounds right. I believe that. We don't take the time to work through it, to test it for ourselves. So that, you know, garbage is sort of, not garbage, but those beliefs we're holding are taking up a portion of the mind that is perhaps necessary for the one to have their eyes open, their heart open, and their mind open to see what the other one sees.
We're thinking also, I think it was said, if one was raised very orthodoxly in her orthodox religion and takes it to heart, there's some things that they'll have to unlearn before anything makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And it also could be that, you know, all things being equal, if one, in this life, all things being equal in this life between the two, if one of them had studied these ideas in previous lives and really assimilated into their mind, then it's really just a reawakening.
Yes.
It's already been there and picking up where you left off.
Absolutely. That would be another absolute explanation, yes.
I mean, I think there's also another thing going on that has to do with pride and humility. There's this Zen story about how a well-known Western professor from a famous university came to visit a Zen master and asked him to teach him everything about meditation. And he couldn't stop talking about what he knew. And so it got to the point where it was almost time for him to catch his plane, and the Zen master just took out a teapot and poured his tea until it kept brimming over. He said, "What are you doing? There's no tea in there." And he says, "Yes, if you don't empty your cup, no new ideas can go in."
Exactly.
Now go on the plane.
Exactly. And that's another idea about the silence. There's a phrase we've heard when we're talking to someone, particularly if they're asking us pointed questions that perhaps we know we shouldn't answer a certain way. There's a phrase, "Thus have I heard," or "Thus I know." And that goes to the pride and the humility. As you were saying, the eager one was telling everything they knew, and the master was waiting to offer, "Thus have I heard," not taking any personal part in that truth. So listen to people. Those who are awake and aware and compassionate and trying to be of service often will be in the shadows and will just tell a story and "thus have I heard" and not want the credit for it. That's one way we can think about it. We have, we want to finish up with a part of this today's reading at the very end, which we think is very poignant. "From birth to death, every man is weaving thread by thread around himself his destiny. But from the very beginning, the stern and implacable law of compensation steps in and takes its course. That self-made destiny then either fixes him like the inert shell against the immovable rock, or like a feather, carries him away in a whirlwind raised by his own actions." Meeting adjourned.